Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. As usual, I'm your host, Sam Notlow. Last time, I talked about Securus, one of the two major prison telecom companies, with the other being Global Tellink. Securus is the exclusive telecom provider of IDOC, meaning that they're the only telecom option to communicate with those in Illinois state facilities. So that's why specifically we talked about Securus, as opposed to Global Tellink or just the system in general. So as a brief rundown of what we talked about last time, so basically, research and, frankly, common sense have shown that communication is very important for incarcerated peoples. Communication is an important tool to prevent alienation of imprisoned persons, as well as to keep them connected to the lives that they lived before imprisonment, and also, clearly, the same lives that they'll go back to afterwards. During the current pandemic, you know, this attachment becomes even more important and urgent as there are actual lives on the line, right? Communication isn't just how did you do today, even though that's very important. It's basically like, how are you doing right now? Like, are you still alive? How is everyone in the family? Things like that. However, despite this urgency, it's basically been given the opposite treatment in many places. You know, there's a lot of families saying that it's actually been hard to get any information on their loved ones on the inside at all, even if those same people have been hospitalized. So despite all this, communication is often prohibitively expensive for the incarcerated and their families. So actually a third of incarcerated people's families actually go into debt solely to pay for the price of communicating, which is often of terrible quality anyways. Last time we talked about a story of a person who went through this whole system to basically get on a video call with their sister at this 30-minute interval, which was determined 24 hours before, and then she couldn't even connect the whole time. And tech support for Securus just wasn't really helpful. Afterwards, they just dodged all her calls and everything. So the thing that you get, honestly, isn't even of any reasonable quality anyways. So the reason for the prohibitive price is, as usual, corporate greed and kickbacks that actually often determine who gets the telecom contract in the first place. And so, if all that sounds bad to you, Securus was actually found to be even worse. A hack and leak of Securus's data by an activist actually showed that the company had been illegally storing confidential calls between the imprisoned and their attorneys, as well as storing millions of calls between the incarcerated and their loved ones. The justification for storing the personal calls is usually something like security, which is if they were talking about something that could injure the security of the prison or people outside the prison, like if they're talking about jailbreaking or something like that. But storing millions of calls for years is clearly way past that warrant of, you know, storing these things for security. It's a clear invasion of privacy. Furthermore, and this is probably the really scary part to, you know, just people in general, Securus was found to have been handing out GPS location data to law enforcement without any warrants needed. And this wasn't just for the location of the incarcerated, though I think that itself would be appalling enough, the fact that people don't even have the freedom to go where they want to go without being tracked. As the thing is, Securus had the power to do this to anyone, and it's not just like they had this power and they didn't use it, they actually did so. A prominent example is that a sheriff in Minnesota, I believe, used Securus's service to track a local judge and state highway personnel. Basically, the only check that Securus did was on their online portal. They just have this little box that you check to say, oh yeah, I'm doing this with permission to do this. Like, I'm doing this. It basically just means, like, I'm doing this with a warrant or with permission for whatever I'm requesting. But so that's all about what we talked about last time. With that long recap over, let's get into today's topic. If you're more interested in stuff about Securus, I urge you to listen to last week's episode. I thought it was pretty interesting. It was a good look into Securus in particular. But for today's topic. So today we're going to talk about language. We might actually extend this into the next show as well, given that there's so much to talk about in the first place. Language shapes the lens by which we view the world, and yet we often don't think much about its role in our everyday life, or the specific ways in which it, or the people using it, can manipulate us. For those currently incarcerated, I think it's an issue of particular relevance. So to begin with, I want to actually go over a Marshall Project commentary from April 3rd, 2015, by Blair Hickman, and this is actually probably going to take us through to the end of this. So the topic was actually on nomenclature for the incarcerated. You know, what do they prefer to be called? The options the Marshall Project gave them were incarcerated person, prisoner, and inmate. And then there's the option other for people to just fill in whatever they wanted. So, just to get the numbers out of the way, 38% preferred incarcerated person, 23% preferred prisoner, and 10% preferred inmate. The remaining 30% preferred the other category, which includes titles like man, woman, or person in prison, man, woman, person who is incarcerated, or their specific names, etc. Just to let you know what that other category was mostly about. So, I think that there was one stark divide that was pretty apparent to me from reading the specific responses. So the Marshall Project actually chose certain responses to show as the commentary for each response. And so one stark divide was that there's a pretty big difference between two general sides, as it were. And what I'm referring to as the two sides are the people that are more like on the defense side of the incarcerated, activists, the incarcerated or previously incarcerated themselves, criminal defense lawyers, etc. And you have people who are more on the offensive side, people like prison guards and wardens. Now, this isn't to say that everyone fell into these categories neatly or that they all voted neatly in this way, but despite that, there was still like a pretty apparent distribution when you look at the responses that were shown from the Marshall Project. So back to the point. The defensive side actually overwhelmingly preferred the other prisoner or incarcerated person responses, while the quote, offensive side seemed wholly sequestered to the inmate response. So you'd have this section, the people who prefer inmate actually being people like prior wardens or people who were prior correctional officers, things like that. And furthermore, the defensive side often called out the term inmate as one that they specifically despised and found dehumanizing. So it wasn't just that they preferred to be called a prisoner or incarcerated person or a person who was incarcerated, something like that. They really also just didn't want to be called inmate. So I think that's also an interesting observation to make, and we'll talk a bit about why they don't like the word inmate. But first, we'll talk about the people who did choose the word inmate, right? So those responding inmate chose it because they said that the term was clean, clinical, it covered a wide population of people. One respondent said that it was more versatile, in addition to those covering, as it covered those in psychiatric hospitals and immigration detention centers. I do think that I have an issue with this specific response because it conflates the issue of those being imprisoned in general population and everything with those who have psychiatric issues. I think that there is some overlap between the two, but it's probably pretty offensive to tell one group that they are also a part of this other group, which, like, with mental health and everything, I think that seems pretty offensive to me personally. But so, anyways, the consensus in general seemed to be that it was a good term, the term inmate, because it was simple and direct. With some people basically saying, well, it's just what we call them. Like, there was a warden who said, well, this is just what we call them while we were there. This is what all the staff call them. But this seemed to display a pretty significant lack of understanding as to the power of the word itself. Those responding otherwise, the defensive side, called the term inmate disparaging. They said that officers would call them that with a tone of disgust. They said that they were often referred to as, like, inmate some number, like inmate 27402-038 per one respondent, and that it seemed to create an underclass called the inmates. So not only was it a term that people said to them with disgust, but it clearly set them apart from everyone else at the prison. It clearly established a hierarchy that they were the bottom rung on. Furthermore, they said that they felt like it implied guilt, as if everyone was rightfully convicted. To this point, with the word itself, some were actually rebuked harshly by the guards for calling themselves that was an inmate. The respondent in question said that they called themselves a prisoner, and that they were sharply told by the guard that it was against the rules for them to even call themselves that, and that it was subversive to the facility's order that they called themselves something that wasn't female inmate, which is apparently the term that they'd been designated under. So among that same group of respondents, which were the people who, again, defensive side, so they wanted to say things like prisoner or incarcerated person or other, or like another category. So among that same group, there was a strong emphasis on personhood used in the nomenclature. Now, as a small caveat before I get into this argument, which is for the term incarcerated people, I will say one thing. There are also people that strongly prefer the term prisoner over other ones. One letter to the editor, for example, said, quote, I was held prisoner for 17 years, and I describe myself as a former prisoner. I think if that title was good enough for Jack Longdon, Lead Belly, Vladimir Lenin, Malcolm X, and more, it's good enough for me. So this is just to say that it's not like everyone is in agreement about this being the best term. Some actually feel like it's too PC to really describe their experience. But so with that out of the way, I'll kind of talk about why the respondents thought that incarcerated people was the best one. So one respondent actually previously worked at the UN's International Criminal Tribunal with a team that prosecuted seven men responsible for the mass killing of over 3,000 Muslim men and boys. And what their research found when they were part of this case was that one of the most important steps to enable them to commit such an atrocity was the renaming of the victims in the months before it, you know, getting everyone in the habit of calling them something other than people, you know. So instead of incarcerated people, for example, you'd call them something like inmate or prisoner. Another response reaffirmed that statement, saying that the public was less likely to become outraged about human rights abuses against people in jails, prisons, etc., if the people that they were abusing are not people, you know, they're not thought of as mothers, brothers, sisters, fathers, but rather inmates, detainees, felons, rapists, addicts, etc. And I think that makes a lot of sense on an intuitive level, right? Just think of the emotions that you attach to these words. You have a lot of positive emotions, probably, that are attached to the ideas of family, but not really any that are attached to words describing those who are incarcerated, or, you know, really any words that pretend to do that either. Furthermore, I think that we can even look at the words themselves. You know, they're words laden with accusation, with the idea that some one thing a person has done can define them. Let's use an example completely outside of the justice system, for example, right? Let's say your father goes out, and one day, unfortunately, he crashes his car. It costs a lot to replace the car, and it places a significant stress on your household. So despite all that, despite the fact that he did do this thing and it did have an impact on your life and everything, you still wouldn't go around calling him a car crasher, right? Instead of dad, you'd still call him your dad. You'd introduce him to people as your dad, and you wouldn't want other people to call him the car crasher either, right? After the event, you wouldn't want people to call him the ex-car crasher or something like that, as if this was just a thing that should follow him around for his whole life. Or what if, you know, he didn't even crash the car? You know, this is analogous to someone who's wrongfully accused. Imagine that someone T-boned him at an intersection, but he was wrongfully accused of being a car crasher. Well, certainly you wouldn't want that to happen either, right? Because he's your father, he's someone that you care about, you have a lot of positive emotions about him, and if you think about the word father, you have a lot of positive emotions probably about that word as well. Well, you know, the same is true for the incarcerated. As I said earlier, they aren't even necessarily guilty of what they're accused of, but they're labeled as if they are. You know, when you say someone in prison is a rapist, you're not really saying, well, he was convicted of rape, and there's a good chance that he was prosecuted, and here are all the details on his case and everything. You're just saying, nope, this is what he is. There's the assumption that they're guilty. And even within the term itself, you know, after all, most people just presume that if you're in prison, you're guilty, you know, that if you're there, you're there for a reason. But this isn't necessarily true, you know, by the high rate of false imprisonments and confessions under duress. And the other thing is, it doesn't really even combat the idea of, well, are the people who are in prisons, like, are the laws that convicted them even just laws to begin with? You know, like, you have things like, you have sodomy laws, which were used to convict people who were homosexual in the past. If you said that they were just a prisoner, you aren't talking about what specific law convicted them. You're just like, no, they were in prison. You're lumping everyone together under the same idea that they're all guilty and that everything that they did was worth putting them in prison for. And let's say, even if it was true, right, even if this all was true, does it really mean that this should define who you are for the rest of your life? Does it mean that you're defined only by this event, by this thing that you had done, if you were actually guilty in the first place? Well, you could say, surely that's untrue, right? We don't define people by just these things, because after they get out, they aren't prisoners or inmates or whatever anymore. But as we've shown here itself, when we've talked about things like housing discrimination and employment discrimination for the previously incarcerated, that's clearly not right. But since we're talking about language, I think it's even wrong when we look at the language of how we describe the previously incarcerated themselves. First, think of how ludicrous it is that we even have terms with such baggage like ex-prisoner or ex-inmate. I don't necessarily mean the term itself, though that's part of it, but the idea that we have a term that encompasses this group, and that whenever we use it, such a stereotypical image comes up for so many people, even though such people, you know, people who were in prison, such people come from literally all walks of life, right? It's really weird to say that there is this idea of a stereotypical prisoner when there are, first of all, just so many crimes out there, and second of all, so many backgrounds that might lead someone to commit such a crime. So despite that, despite all that, when you say someone is an ex-prisoner, your first thought isn't likely, well, okay, but what else is there about him? Or even, well, did he actually do the crime or anything even like that? You know, most people don't think that in-depth when they hear someone is an ex-prisoner. It's probably just, oh, this guy is bad news. And for those that are deeply involved with the justice system and those subject to it, the thought of this connection is abhorrent. You know, if you have a loved one who's been imprisoned, or if you're an activist, or if you're imprisoned yourself. But I don't think that it would be surprising to most people that this is the idea that others have of them. And I think that it is, unfortunately, the attitude that most people will have when they hear such a term. Despite the fact, and that's all despite the fact, again, that the term really has very little bearing on the actual humanity of the person themselves. Literally all the term says is that someone was, at some prior point, incarcerated. That's it. That's all the term actually says. But despite all that, we have so many preconceptions of what, you know, a prisoner is, or someone who's been to prison is, or their experiences. But now let's come back to the term itself, right? There's also the fact that we have really specific terms like ex-prisoner or ex-inmate, which we know are offensive to start with. The fact that people who were incarcerated say that these things were offensive, specifically that the word inmate was used to oppress them. There's the fact that we know that these terms were used for such a means, yet we continue to use them in common parlance. Now, we already know that these terms have a lot of baggage, but the fact that these terms exist and are so widely used, it sends a clear message that no matter where you go or what you do after your incarceration, you will still carry it around with you. You know, that no matter what you change or what impact you make, some part of you will still be substantially defined by your incarceration. You know, it's why, okay, you're not a prisoner anymore, but now you're an ex-prisoner, or you're not an inmate anymore, but you're an ex-inmate. You know, it's you just tack ex onto the word, and apparently can still be used to describe you no matter what you do for the rest of your life. And there's a stark pain, I think, that's clear in those who are subject to such terms. I could try and describe it from my privileged point of view, but I can think of no better way to describe it than to actually read out loud one response to the Marshall Project from Daryl Atkinson, who is an attorney at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. So here's his response. When you examine the history of this country, whenever America wanted to oppress or dominate a particular group of people, they first began with the language they used to describe that particular group of people. When America wanted to justify taking indigenous people's land, we described them as savages. When America wanted to justify the chattel slavery of African people, we called them jigabo, monkey, or the N-word, terms that debase their humanity. The list goes on and on. Lastly, I respectfully disagree with your argument that pejorative labels like ex-convict are accurate descriptors of people who have been to prison. The analysis is similar to one put forth by undocumented advocates when they began the I campaign. Labels like ex-convict describe conduct that I engaged in, which may have violated the law, but they do not describe the full breadth of my humanity. So in 1996, I was convicted of drug trafficking. Since that time, I have attained my associate's, bachelor's, and juris doctor degrees. I'm licensed to practice law in Minnesota and North Carolina. I have been honored at the White House. I'm a deacon in my church. I'm a husband, a father, and a valued member of my community. It's unfortunate and a disservice to the full breadth of my humanity to solely define me by my contact with the criminal legal system. I'm more than the sum total of my contact with the criminal legal system. When the Marshall Project began, I got the impression that you all wanted to report on issues related to criminal legal reform in a different way, to hopefully spur change and reform. Changing the language you all use to refer to the people entangled in the criminal legal system will make you a leader in the media and further the progression of this moment. Thank you for the opportunity to give my perspective. And again, that was Daryl Atkinson. Now, many of you may be thinking at this point, you know, you're sympathetic to everything, you heard everything, and you think, no, I get why this is a bad thing. I think that it's bad too, but you know, we still need a term to describe this group of people by. You know, that's just how language works. We think of words to describe groups of people, because we want to give meaning to things. We want to be able to talk about things. But the point that I want to make is that we should also question why this language exists in the first place. Why do we use terms like ex-prisoner or ex-convict or ex-inmate in the first place? Nobody says that adults are ex-children, they're just adults. If you got detention in school, you aren't forevermore known as an ex-detentionee. No one, that doesn't really follow you around. There's no reason for you to be called that, right? Because there's the idea of, well, you did some crime in school or whatever, you went to detention and then you got out, you learned your lesson. It seems that there's like this implicit idea that even if you go through the justice system, you haven't learned your lesson, that you deserve some black mark on you for the rest of your life when you think of terms like ex-prisoner or ex-convict, the fact that these terms exist and are used. Words are created for a purpose. The purpose isn't only to describe a thing, it's also specifically in order to add baggage and meaning to that thing in particular. And that isn't necessarily something bad, right? The same way that there's nothing bad about the warm feelings that are conjured up when you think of a stereotypical father or mother or sister or brother, if you think of those words, for those of you who are fortunate enough to have had positive experiences with those people. But that is built through a lifetime of observation and experience, right? Like, you grow up with your parents, you grow up with your siblings, like, those words have meaning to you. Because they've been reinforced so much, what they actually mean. But then, really contrast this for a second then. What actual first-hand experience do you think most people have with those that have been incarcerated? Do you think most people know the struggles that the incarcerated face in the justice system, whether it is during pre-trial, trial, in jail, prison, etc.? Do you think that many people have the same first-hand experience? No. And it's not particularly bad that they don't have a first-hand experience of everything, but here's the issue. Many of these same people will think that they know what a stereotypical ex-prisoner, ex-convict, ex-whatever is because of the ideas that they have been fed about such people and by the words themselves. Remember the ideas behind housing discrimination and employment discrimination. These are probably built into company policy and everything, these ideas that are written by people that don't actually have any real contact with people who've been a part of the justice system or any real idea of what that entails. And remember again that these words imply that the person deserved everything. Not only that they were guilty, but that they deserved to be subject to some nebulous prison system, despite many people not actually knowing what that system even entails. So then what you end up is this huge group of people who have zero experience with the incarcerated or the previous incarcerated, but they still think they have some idea of what their experience is and what that person is like. What this stereotypical ex-prisoner might be like, despite the fact that stereotypical ex-prison doesn't really exist in the first place. Not only because of what they've been told such people are like through media or whatever, but because even if they ignored all that, right, even if they ignored the things that they heard from media, like let's say you're someone who's woke or whatever, and you know that a lot of this stuff is, it's basically lies or it's shaping the lives of prisoners in a way that isn't reflective of who they really are. The thing is, even if you ignore all that, you can't ignore the foundations of the language itself. Language reinforces itself by usage, As a word is used more, its meaning becomes stronger as usage spreads and the idea of the word embeds itself in our minds. Which means that an oppressive language will continue to oppress even more, even if the user themselves doesn't bear any ill intention. And I think this just makes sense from an intuitive sense as well, right? Like, let's say you heard about someone, right? And instead of saying their name, people always just refer to them as the bad man. People always said, "Oh yeah, the bad man did this and the bad man did that." I don't think that most people would think that this was a good person. It doesn't matter what you said the bad man did or didn't do. Just merely by the fact that you keep calling them the bad man, even if you don't have any ill intention towards them, the usage of that language itself will sprout that meaning into your own mind because you don't have any first-hand experience. So really what you have are the things you're told about them and the word itself. And so then you have this issue, right? Which is, it's not just that language is a reminder of the oppression that they face. That's one big issue, but it's not just that it's a reminder of that experience and everything. It's that the language itself is the oppression. And so when we tackle things like language. That's what makes these issues so important. Why, instead of calling inmate or convict or something, people want to be called prisoner or incarcerated individual, or maybe they don't want to be for these reasons. It's not just the things that the language entails, it's that the language itself, the word itself that you say, has meaning through usage. And that's why so many people care so much about these things. That's why there was that entire article written on it and over 200 respondents to that that initial question of what do people want to be called. And so with that having been said, thank you for listening today. I think we're actually going to do another episode on the same topic next time, given how much more stuff we can talk about. It's probably not all just going to be on this one article, but, you know, the general idea of language. And if that ends up just being a short part of the next episode, that's fine. We'll just talk about other things after that. I think that this topic is really interesting in that you don't need any research to come to these conclusions. It's there if you're the kind of person that wants to seek it out, if you like data and science papers and things. There's literature on dehumanizing language and such, dating back probably thousands of years. But you don't need it to understand everything here. Because the thing that we're talking about is just language. It's the thing that we all use every day. And all you really need to do to understand it, at least on a personal level, is to look inwards. And so, as always, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, feel free to email prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com. Be safe, be well, and I'll talk.